Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what is up with all these grasshoppers? An Arizona bug lover says we have nothing to fear and maybe something to love. And a life-altering letter from London reconnects a sculptor with her late husband. But first, family members of migrants, as well as forensic investigators who study migrant deaths, are reeling in the wake of a puzzling outage at the Colibri Center for Human Rights. The center has played a key role in identifying remains of migrants for the last decade. But as of late last year, the state of Arizona is working to dissolve the organization, which hasn't filed critical paperwork. To explain how this whole mess happened, I am joined now by Caroline Tracy, reporter for the Border Chronicle, who has been covering this. Caroline, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So, Caroline, the centerpiece of Colibri's work was this big database that matched missing persons reports and human remains with DNA samples. Tell us why this was such a significant project.
Yeah, the Colibri Center for Human Rights was created in 2013 at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner, which is the medical examiner that serves not only Tucson and Pima County, but three of Arizona's four border counties. And so in the early 2000s, they were handling a lot of remains that were presumed to be of deceased migrants. And they didn't have a great way to connect those remains with family members that could have been anywhere in the U.S. or even around Latin America. And so in 2013 and then in 2016, there were two sort of incorporations of Colibri. They created a nonprofit organization that had a database of missing persons reports that family members could file, but then they also began to do DNA collection from family members so that those DNA samples could be cross-referenced with the skeletal remains that the medical examiner's office had.
And this work was a really big deal, right? I mean, this was making it possible to identify people who otherwise could have gone unaccounted for possibly forever.
Exactly. There wasn't any other way. When you have skeletal remains, there's no other way besides DNA in most cases to produce an identification. And in Arizona, there was no other way to connect these remains to their loved ones.
So as you have reported, Caroline, over the years, the pressures of running this organization and this database became very intense for its leadership. In particular, the co-founder, an anthropologist named Robin Reinecke. What happened?
Yeah, Robin Reinecke is a cultural anthropologist who founded or co-founded Colibri while she was working in close collaboration with the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner. And then she served as its director for several years. But as you can imagine, it was a stressful organization to run, both, you know, the sort of deep grief that comes with dealing with the dead and the missing all the time, but also, of course, the normal financial pressures of running a nonprofit. So Reinecke ended up stepping down as director in July 2019.
And eventually, this guy, Jason De Leon, became the head of Colibri. Tell us who he was.
Jason De Leon is a well-known anthropologist who, at the time that he joined Colibri's board in 2017, had written a book called The Land of Open Graves, which is a really important work that catalogs the way that U.S. border policy created the crisis of migrant death in the desert and how organizations like Colibri had responded.
And so De Leon's tenure at Colibri, I know there was a lot of excitement about it initially because of his significance to the work. But his time quickly became controversial, right?
Yes. De Leon joined the board of the organization in 2017, and then he was named executive director in 2021. He had been running his own nonprofit called the Undocumented Migration Project, and the decision by the board was to merge the two organizations. One of the things that we uncovered in our reporting is that that merger never legally was finished, and so the organizations have continued to exist as two separate organizations. But what became controversial between De Leon and the staff was questions of protocol and ethics and the presence of people from outside the organization at DNA collection events, which was something that the existing staff of Colibri found very objectionable and had been outside of their protocols, and then also the efficiency with which they sent the DNA samples that they collected for processing. It had been in the past Colibri's policy that those samples needed to be sent immediately for processing, that it was unethical to hold them for a lot of time. It was not in the family's interests to do that. And what the staff reported, what they complained about to the board, was that numerous samples had not been sent in for processing under De Leon's tenure.
So all of these problems began to mount, and De Leon eventually resigned. And that seems to be when things really fell apart. In particular, access to Colibri's DNA database, which, as we've been talking about, is basically the linchpin of this project, went down. Do we know how that happened or why?
Yes, there. We sort of know the chain of events. The DNA program managers expressed their concerns to Colibri's board or to one specific member of the board in 2022 about DNA not being sent for processing, and later those staff were fired. So in September of 2023, those staff were fired, and then a after that, in 2024, De Leon sent a letter of resignation to Colibri's board. That was October 17th, 2024. And within a week, the partner organizations that also used Colibri's database discovered that not only did they not have access to the database, but it appeared that the database was no longer being hosted.
So I know you and your reporting have tried to reach De Leon. It seems like at this point, the continued existence of the project is in jeopardy. We have just about 30 seconds left here, Caroline. Where do things stand?
Well, we were able to speak with De Leon, but because De Leon says that he resigned, he said that the other board members are the people that would know where the database are. We found them harder to reach. We did speak with them very briefly, but we didn't get a conclusive answer.
Okay. Well, lots to keep an eye on. Caroline Tracy is a reporter at the Border Chronicle who will be covering this. Caroline, thank you for talking to us about this.
Thank you.
As you have probably noticed, the recent surge in temperatures here in the valley has brought an attendant surge of grasshoppers. We have seen reports around the region of people worrying about the massive number of bugs hopping around their gardens, yards, or in my case, the lobby of my apartment building. So are they anything to worry about? And how long will it last? Let's hop on the line with someone who can explain it. Steve Miller, a pest control expert and bug collector, joins me now. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
I am doing well, my lobby infestation aside. So, Steve, tell us what these grasshoppers are and why they're here.
Well, basically, it's a perfect storm. We had a really wet fall in Phoenix, and then we had a really early spring that got really hot really soon. So, basically, the moisture in the ground let the eggs hatch, and then all the extra vegetation for them to eat is a perfect storm for them, really. And with the hotter temperatures drying out the desert around the outskirts of Phoenix, they're kind of coming closer indoors, closer to the city where there's irrigation and greenery for them to feed on. So that's why we're seeing more of them around the city for the most part.
I see. Okay. And you mentioned that they like to snack on vegetation, and including in people's gardens, which I know is a concern for some. Are they dangerous? Is there anything to worry about here? It can obviously be unsettling when you see a cluster of them kind of burst into midair when you take a step outside. But are they dangerous?
They're not dangerous at all. They're kind of more beneficial for like the birds and the lizards who like to snack on them. So they're not poisonous or venomous or nothing like that. They're just an abundance of them right now. So
okay.
Nothing really to worry about right now.
Okay, that's good for the bug phobes in the listening audience. I include myself in that group. I imagine in your work in pest control, you must be getting a lot of calls to take care of the grasshoppers. How do you approach that? What's the best way to catch a grasshopper?
So best way, if you wanted to catch a grasshopper, there's really two ways to do it. I mean, you've got the obvious where if you're going out during the daytime, just grab a butterfly net and just go ahead and try to catch one in midair or on the ground if you're fast enough. Or if you get a mercury vapor light bulb, it's on the Home Depot. This is what I collect bugs with myself. And you can set them up at nighttime and they're attracted to the lights and you can just pick them off the ground if you really wanted to collect some.
Okay. Okay. And am I right? I mean, have you been getting an uptick in calls of people saying, you got to help me out? I'm drowning in grasshoppers here.
So I'm actually based in Sierra Vista. We are having a lot of them in Sierra Vista, but nothing on the number that you guys are getting up in Phoenix right now. So, they're definitely abundant right now though, all over the state. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, can I ask you personally, Steve? I mean, I'm very interested in your story because you work in pest control, but you are also an insect enthusiast. You collect bugs, as you were just mentioning.
I do. Yes. I work for Brian the Bug Man. He's based in Pennsylvania and I cover Arizona and California, mostly Phoenix and Tucson, where I bring my bug collection to birthday parties and daycares and church camps, you name it. Anywhere where there's kids who like bugs, basically. And we educate the public about bugs, why they're good, why you should take care of them. Obviously there's some bugs we don't want around the home, but, the kids get to hold the bugs. They learn all about them, and it's a lot of fun. So, but I've been into bugs my whole life, and I actually grew up in England, but I came to the States in 2011.
Okay,
and I came to Arizona for the climate, and there's a lot of cool bugs here, especially in Sierra Vista. So that's kind of why I'm down here. So,
what do you love about them? How'd you fall in love with bugs?
I don't really know. They're just so interesting to me. They're so alien-like, and there's so many different varieties of bugs. They're just really It's always been my thing, you know. It's like this. I know I work in pest control, which means it sounds like I hate bugs, but in reality, I love bugs. So,
well, do those two things ever come into conflict? I mean, I imagine sometimes for work reasons, you are called upon to harm creatures that you personally have a great love for.
So usually, the beneficial bugs, like the praying mantises and, you know, the walking sticks and all the cool bugs that we get out here, I'll just bring a container with me and I'll just relocate it or take it home for my bug shows. So
that's okay.
What I do with
I guess
them,
everybody wins in that scenario.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, I get it. There's things like bed bugs and German cockroaches, which you really do not want in the home. So
yeah.
I don't have any sympathy for those whatsoever. So.
Okay. Okay. So you do have limits.
Yes.
I imagine when you go to these birthday parties and stuff, you must encounter some kids who are very resistant, maybe even terrified at the idea of interacting with bugs, looking at them up close, touching them. How do you help kids or even adults get over their phobias?
So it's usually the kids that are less resistant to hold the bug. It's usually the parents that don't want to know. But once they see the kids holding the bugs, they get a little bit of bravery in them, and then they'll go ahead and want to try holding, say, a tarantula or a hissing cockroach or something that looks really scary, but they realize that they're actually harmless. They're not there to hurt you. So that's how they kind of learn to lose their fear of them for the most part.
Interesting. Interesting. And what would you say if you had to pick a favorite bug that you would like to evangelize here on the airwaves to people that they should maybe look to as a way of overcoming their own resistance to bugs? I don't know if you can tell I'm talking about myself here, Steve. what's your favorite bug and why should other people be interested in it?
It is going to be the praying mantis.
Okay.
They are just so cool. I mean, they're harmless. They eat all the bad bugs. They're just really cool looking. They get pretty good sized, and That's always been my favorite bug, so.
Okay. All right. Well, I have been speaking with Steve Miller, who is a bug lover and a pest control expert, who, among other things, wants us to know that we have nothing to fear from the grasshoppers. Steve, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the case for a controversial Easter candy.
I see the peeps and I think about my brother immediately. I think about the holidays spent with him. I think about the years that have passed.
We'll hear from a Valley comedian about the personal power of peeps. But first, Jacqueline Bernard and her husband Kenji Umeda moved to Phoenix in the mid-70s. They had met a few years earlier, studying sculpture in Carrara, Italy. The Valley became home to their family and creative lives until Umeda's death in 2019. Bernard always knew there had been a chapter of Umeda's life before they met, in particular, his time at Kettle's Yard in Cambridge. Umeda arrived in England from Japan, still searching for his creative identity, and he befriended a couple named Jim and Helen Ead. They owned a cluster of cottages where they hosted artists, and Umeda lived there at Kettle's Yard for a time, sketching, reading, and having long talks with Jim. Eventually, he made his way to Italy to learn how to carve stone and met Jacqueline. These days, Kettle's Yard is still active as a contemporary art museum, and back in 2024, a curator there made a startling discovery, a suitcase packed with a few of Kenji Umeda's belongings. The items are currently on display at Kettle's Yard, but before the curator put the exhibition together, she sent Jacqueline a letter telling her what she'd found.
It had his personal belongings, his clothes, some books, some sketch pads with drawings, some personal items like a pipe and a little pot and a travel watch, things like that. And she wanted to know what I wanted to do with them since they had found them.
And what went through your mind in that moment?
I thought it was remarkable to receive a letter with that description. But I had remembered that Kenji had told me that he had left a trunk there and that in one day he hoped to go back. But, you know, time passed, life happened, and he never went back. And that was that, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So there's kind of an interesting implication in that, in my mind, which is that he was aware that he had left this trunk and that it had some things in it.
Yes.
But it seems like in his mind, it was not so urgent to retrieve these items that
That's
it necessitated
right.
like a special trip.
Yes, it wasn't urgent. His urgency was to become a sculptor.
So that was really what was at the forefront of his mind.
Yes, it was.
What did it bring up for you when you saw them? Because, I mean, the personal correspondence, the sketches, these are
yes.
also such rich artifacts of a person. Did you see the man you knew in the correspondence, say, or in the sketches?
Yes, I did see. Mm-hmm. I did see him. I saw his early types of work that he'd done, and I recognized some of the forms, but then some of them were like small drawings that he imagined would be a sculpture or something. It was a drawing. They were early works of Kenji's, things that I had not seen because I met him in 1974 and he had gone to England in 1971. But in those letters, he mentions that he had met an American friend and
right.
that was me.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Little
right.
did he know and little did I know that we would, you know, eventually go west
uh-huh.
and come to Arizona and be a couple. And actually, we got married just before coming here.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that brought you guys to the Valley originally
yes. Yes.
was you had a you sold a piece, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Did you read something about that?
Yes, I did. I did. Tell me that story.
So some of my relatives moved to Arizona, to, you know, Scottsdale in 1976. I came to visit and I saw the galleries here. So I brought a sculpture to show to a gallery. It was Elaine Harwich Gallery. And this was like in May. And they sold the sculpture during the summertime, which is sort of like the low season for art So we decided, well, if they could sell in the summertime, maybe this is a good opportunity to come to Arizona. Uh-huh. We took a big chance. We had worked very hard for several years, and we had quite a few sculptures. It was many crates of sculpture, and we opened the crates in my aunt's garage, and we met Reva Yars, and she came to see the sculptures, and she fell in love with Kenji's work right away. Mm-hmm. So she says, I need to have your work in my gallery. Uh-huh. And that was the beginning. We came all the way out to the West without realizing we'd be staying. I think I've been here about 45 years now.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
Yes.
What impact did bringing your artistry here have on you both?
It took time to acclimate to the desert. Mm-hmm. There's great beauty, but it's kind of a little sparse. I think that leaves you space to think. It was very important to him to have a certain visual aesthetic and a simplicity. He didn't like it overly decorated or super bright colors. Of course, he liked color, but in a more controlled way, like a dot, you know, sort of like an accent rather than a yelling at you.
But that's interesting. You referenced the idea of sparseness earlier.
Yes.
One of the other things that comes up in the commentary that I've seen about this trunk of belongings,
yes,
this idea of kind of doing one thing and doing it well. Like
yes,
there was this idea of like he would buy like a fine trench coat, and the idea was that he would always wear that trench coat. Did that resonate with you as well?
Well, when we looked at the collection, I saw that they were like good clothes. Like he had chosen very specific things to look very nice and proper. He was a very proper person. And he knew that he had to look nice so that people could respect him in that way. But those clothes also, I didn't see those clothes when he came to Italy, because we used work clothes. So those were his better clothes that he left behind, the white shoes. I don't think I ever saw him wear white shoes. It was kind of interesting.
It's very striking to me, Jacqueline, that you know, you're talking about this trunk as almost like a time capsule of the moment in his life prior to when he stepped into his identity as a sculptor.
Yes.
Do you feel any sense of ownership over this trunk and the items that were in it? Because I have to imagine it is a strange experience to,
yes,
you know, this was your husband.
Yes.
And these were his things, even if they were from a period of his life before he met you.
Yeah.
And now they're on display.
Yeah.
And are kind of representing him to a new audience of people. What is that like for you? That must be such a curious experience.
Well, it's very emotional because, you know, I'm sorry to cry, but
that's okay.
It is a part of him before I met him, you know. So that's a very emotional thing to know a person that you knew for a long time, but you didn't know them earlier on, you know, that I discovered something more about him, which I knew, but I felt it more in seeing those things. No. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. I realize it's very emotionally potent to relive these things.
Yeah, especially since he's passed. And, you know, but anyway, I think he would be very pleased to see that his pieces were on display at Kettle's Yard.
What will become of the items once the exhibition concludes? Will they come back to you?
No, there a lot of the items I wanted Kettle's Yard to keep for their archives, because they have a large repertory of artists there, and I think it would be best there.
You mentioned he's passed away.
Yes.
He said, was it 2019 that he passed
yes,
away?
Yes, that's right.
I'm very sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you.
Do you have any items in your home now that you keep around that for you kind of stand for him in the way that these items for other people are going to be the way that they maybe meet him for the first time?
Well, at home I have a lot of his sculptures. I have a little bronze head that is mentioned in Jim Eade's letter that I didn't realize there were two, and Jim Eade has one and I have one of them. So that was an interesting actually discovery that I didn't realize that there were two of those. We have a big yard, and there's a lot of trees that he had planted You know, so those things are part of my life.
Well, I have been speaking with Jacqueline Bernard, who is a ceramicist, a textile artist, and as we've been talking about, a stone sculptor, and is also the wife of artist Kenji Umeda, whose personal effects were recently discovered at Kettle's Yard. Jacqueline, thank you for this conversation.
Oh, thank you very much. This is wonderful to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. There are a lot of efforts nationwide right now to reshape American elections. President Trump issued a sweeping executive order just this week aiming to create a verified voter list and seriously limit mail-in voting. In Congress, Republicans are trying to pass the SAVE Act, which would require voters to provide proof of citizenship when they register to vote and photo ID at the polls. Here in Arizona, there are efforts at the state legislature to get rid of the so-called late early ballots that folks drop off on Election Day in hopes of speeding up election results. But our next guest says most Arizonans do not want major changes to elections. Sybil Francis is chair, president, and CEO of the Center for the Future of Arizona, which conducted a new survey of Arizona voters and asked them a slew of questions about elections in our state. They wanted to know, in the eyes of Arizonans, what makes a good election? My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
I want to start with that one really big number here that you found in this survey. 97% of Arizonans across political lines say they believe that fair and secure elections are essential to a healthy democracy. And I just want to start there because I know that you find often in your work that we agree on a lot more than you might think in the political landscape and in policy here in Arizona. But 97% is pretty nearly everybody. Were you surprised by that?
I can't say I was surprised. I was very gratified to hear that. It is the highest number that we've ever gotten on any survey. And wow. We've been doing surveys of Arizonans for nearly 20 years. So it was very encouraging to know that Arizonans understand that fair and secure elections are essential to democracy.
So let's dig into these numbers a little bit, because there were some numbers that were less unanimous. But one thing that most people agreed on is that they value accuracy in elections over speed in elections, right? And this is a point of contention in our state, because our election results tend to be a little slower than they are elsewhere, especially as we're seeing more and more kind of tight elections recently, right?
Yes, absolutely. One of the reasons for, quote unquote, slow returns or slow reports is that, in fact, our elections are getting so close that you really have to count every last vote to make sure that you get an accurate count. We step back to ask Arizonans, what do they prioritize in elections? And yes, we did ask about whether accuracy or speed were most important to them. And 7 out of 10 Arizonans prefer to make sure that we have an accurate count versus having a very speedy result.
Right. Even though that's an issue that's gotten a lot of political play, there's legislation now attempting to restrict the returning of those late early ballots, as they're called. I wonder about one area that you talked about with voters here to do with their trust in our local elected officials. It seems like politics comes into play here a little bit.
Well, it was really interesting. As you may know, we partnered with Bill Gates on some of this work. He's the former supervisor of Maricopa County and very much in the hot seat. And, you know, I think he was especially pleased to see that local election workers and county elections officials are actually the most trusted when it comes to running safe, secure, and fair elections. So that was a really interesting finding, that the closer you get to where people vote, the more people are trusting in those officials.
That's interesting. So the more local, the higher the trust goes up. What about when it comes to our kind of statewide officials on elections?
Yes, they also have a very high level of trust. So local election workers are trusted at 75% level, and state election officials are trusted at 67%. I will say that we do find some gaps between Republicans and Democrats in these areas. Mm-hmm. So we did find 51% of Republicans trust their local elected officials. And so that's you know, probably lower than we want to see. It's still about a majority, but I think that that does point to some work that needs to be done to build up that trust.
Let me ask you about misinformation here. You asked voters about this, and it seems to be a broad concern and one that, you know, seems to be more relevant today than ever, maybe, as we're seeing lots of misinformation around elections, how to vote, things like that. Where did their concerns lie?
So this was one of the highest levels of agreement when we asked about concerns that voters might have around elections. 88% said that they had concerns around misinformation. And some of that really revolved around, you know, are they getting accurate information about where to vote? Are they getting accurate information about the candidates? So there is a lot of concern. You can tell that there is concern around the kinds of information that voters are getting and that they're not feeling confident in it.
Hmm. We are watching this all happen in this context in which there's a lot happening at the federal level as well. There's a lot of election-related bills at the state legislature, but we're watching GOP efforts in Washington to pass the SAVE Act at the federal level, which would really change elections in America. We just saw President Trump issue a sweeping executive order aimed at mail-in voting that would really reshape American elections as well. It would do things like create lists of U.S. citizens who are eligible to vote in each state, things like instructing the Postal Service to only send mail-in ballots to verified voters, things like that. Where do Arizona voters stand on mail-in voting in your polling, but also on, you know, whether or not we should require things like proof of ID for voting?
So Arizonans love to vote by mail. About 81% of Arizonans voted by mail in the last election. And our survey results show that 80% of Arizonans do believe that we should continue to be able to vote by mail. So that is a very, very clear signal that Arizonans enjoy voting by mail. They trust it and they want to be able to continue it. I think that one of the relevant points about the recent Trump announcement regarding sort of federalizing in some ways vote by mail is that, to go back to that question, that Arizonans trust state and local leaders to run their election. So if you start asking the federal government to do certain things, that's going to erode trust. I think it's important for everyone to understand that, in fact, you do have to show an ID in Arizona to vote. So, you know, this is one of the areas of misinformation that is kind of interesting to see, that people are express concern that people may not need to show an ID to vote. But in fact, in Arizona, they do have to show an ID to vote.
Yeah, that's very interesting to point out. And we should say lots of experts say that the president lacks the authority there for that executive order. But we'll see what happens on that front. So let me ask you, Sybil, about funding elections and what voters had to say here. You've been holding events with election officials to talk about this survey data. What have they had to say about the need for funding?
Well, certainly they, you know, in order to do the things that elections officials are being asked to do, resources are required. So it was very gratifying to Bill Gates, our partner in this, to see that Arizonans really do believe that we should be spending more to make sure that our elections are run efficiently and smoothly. We had some of the highest numbers that we've ever had in terms of support for additional funding. And even voters said that they would be willing to pay more in taxes to be able to invest more in elections.
I'm sure that's a high bar.
Yes.
Let me ask you lastly about just the overall picture here as you saw these results come in. I mean, you all do this work and you often find that people agree on more than they disagree on. But these are very contentious issues and hotly debated ones in terms of our, you know, the health of our democracy right now. What was the main takeaway for you?
The main takeaway is that people respect and understand and care passionately about safe, secure, and fair elections. They understand that they're important to our democracy. They believe their vote makes a difference. 79% of Arizonans said their vote makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Their core principles that they care about are accuracy, trustworthiness, and transparency. And I guess a way to say this is they don't want to mess with it. You know, they want to be able to keep voting by mail. They believe in showing a voter ID, and you have to do that in Arizona. So I think what I took away from it is that Arizonans fervently believe in our system. They trust our local election officials, and that they believe their vote matters, so that we should really not be messing with it too much.
Well, that certainly says something about the health of democracy, all right? Sybil Francis, Chair, President, and CEO of the Center for the Future of Arizona, joining us. Sybil, thank you so much. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
Well, it is going to be a busy weekend for basketball fans. And we're not just talking about the NCAA men. The NCAA women's basketball Final Four begins tomorrow in Phoenix. Working with a local nonprofit, Phoenix artist Antoinette Cauley painted a mural to celebrate women's basketball. And she chose to highlight the talents of some younger players in the Valley. Show producer Athena Ankra has the story.
Antoinette Cauley has done a number of public art projects in Phoenix. You may have seen her nine-story portrait of James Baldwin on Roosevelt Street. When Downtown Phoenix, Inc., a local nonprofit promoting economic development in the city, approached her to commission a mural celebrating the women's Final Four, she says she had a gut feeling about what to do.
So I had the idea, like, instantly that I should paint and highlight high school girl basketball players from around the Valley in the mural.
Cauley got in touch with local high school coaches and did her own research to find players to feature in the mural.
I looked for girls who, if I spoke to like community members or teachers or families, they would have, you know, nothing but good things to say. And just girls with like so much like heart and skill. And it's just, they're all incredibly impressive. I went to see all of them play before I painted the mural, and I was like, yo, I can't paint them and not go to the game. Like, I have to see them play. I got to go support them. And I knew the energy. I could feed off of that energy as well.
She landed on four players from across Metro Phoenix. Jayana Bogan-Jacobs is a freshman and a point guard at Campo Verde High School in Gilbert.
Ever since I stepped on the court, I've been loving basketball. And to me, it's my everything. This is like my life. So when I found out about this, it made me even want to work even harder for it. I can't believe I'm on a wall and that everyone else can see, and I'm really proud of myself for that.
Deja Richardson is a junior and a point guard at Millennium High School in Goodyear. Her team just won the state championship for the second year in a row.
I've been playing basketball since I was 6 years old. So I love the game. I've watched the game. March Madness is my favorite time of the year. So just to see myself up there and during this movement of just women's sports just growing, it feels good to really be a part of it. I'd never had someone come and paint me or do anything like that. So honestly, it was just really wholesome, and I'm really thankful for the opportunity to be a part of it.
Also featured in the mural are freshman Taji Freeman at North High School and Colby Brooks at Desert Vista. Cauley says this project meant a lot to her as a former basketball player and forever fan herself, especially given the explosion of interest in the WNBA and women's sports overall.
This mural is so important right now because there's so much attention on the league that we need to pull that into other areas as well and make sure that people don't forget that these girls are going to be in these leagues one day. You know, these are future leaders in our communities. Like, these are girls that, you know, little girls are going to look up to and want to play like one day too. So this mural, I really want it to serve as a call to action to people to support these girls and any girls in our community who need it.
You can see the mural titled We Got Next near 2nd Street and Adams, across the street from Symphony Hall. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra.
The NCAA Women's Tournament wraps up Sunday afternoon with the championship game in downtown Phoenix. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. As Easter approaches, so too does the renewed debate about Peeps, the popular yet much maligned marshmallow candy that some people love and others love to hate. Count Phoenix comedian Anwar Newton among those with mixed feelings about Peeps. As you may recall, he told a story on the show a while back about his brother's tradition of giving him Peeps for Christmas. For an Easter reconsideration of the controversial confection, I recently invited Newton back to the studio.
It's not an unfamiliar feeling to have these cravings for certain foods that, you know, you don't actually go for for me that's been with Butterfinger candy. So yep. You never hear anybody eat those. Candy corn. I love eating those. Mm-hmm. People hate that. Pineapple on pizza too. And the craving came out of my brain and out my mouth to a family member. Uh-huh. And obviously they took that as their life's mission from that point on to just go get me these Peeps.
Right, right. And this family member was your brother.
My brother.
Who is how much older than you?
Oh, jeez. I've never even thought of that. maybe a decade older.
Okay.
Around there.
So this annoying inside joke that it seems like he sort of imposed on you.
yeah.
Became also kind of a stand-in for your connection with him in this interesting way. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. My brother and his wife and his children, he has two sons and a daughter. For a long stretch of time, I was around them for the holidays. I moved out to where they lived in Nevada around my college years, and I spent a lot of holidays with them. And I didn't have a great memory of the holidays. Mm-hmm. We were very poor growing up. A lot of time was spent like not getting Christmas presents and having our mom promise us that birthdays would be the one that we go really crazy for. And I think that resonates with a lot of people who grew up, you know, under the poverty line. When I started to live around my brother and his family, he also had that upbringing. And so he really went out of his way to provide Christmas when he was able to, mm-hmm. which was all the time when he was older.
Yeah.
So naturally, I just really idolized him for being able to do that and not being in the same position our parents were in when it came to the holidays.
Uh-huh. So he would always give you Peeps for Christmas.
Yeah.
But then there came a point, if I'm not mistaken, where he then moved away, or maybe you moved away. And the Peeps thing stopped.
Yeah.
When that happened, do you feel like you kept the association with the candy? Like, if you would go to a store around Christmas or Easter, there's Peeps for all seasons.
Peeps for all seasons.
Did they still make you think about him when you would see them?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that every time I see Peeps in stores, I think about my brother. That's very weird to think about because I've never thought about that till you've put that in front of me. Like when I'm in the store around this time, you know, Easter, I see the Peeps and I think about my brother immediately. I think about the holidays spent with him. I think about the years that have passed. The passage of time is really big. Like it's really a signifier of how long the tradition's been going and just how far we've come as siblings.
So the question I kind of wanted to put to you about this is, you know, Peeps, in my mind, fall into a category, and you were naming some of these things, right? Like Butterfingers, candy corn. I think of them as like instant regret foods. Like, you know, you put them in your mouth and like there's a split second where you're like, that's the flavor I wanted. And you're like, oh, no.
Right. Yeah, it's usually just for a moment. I'm also just like, I don't know why I do this, but I love things that people hate. Uh-huh. I know there was a point where a friend group, my closest friend group, actually, we would go to Chili's ironically. We would go to Chili's ironically. And I remember one time I was with my brother and he was going to drop me off at Chili's where my friends were. We were going to go see a movie after we had made this big ironic day where we're going to eat Chili's and go see the worst movie at the movie theater because of our love of things everyone hated.
Do you remember the movie?
It was the Charlize Theron Aeon Flux movie, I think it was called. It was like the worst one. We were like, we're going to go watch this and we're going to spend a good amount of money. We're going to make a day of it.
Right.
And I remember on the ride over, I remember telling my brother this. I'm like, oh, we're going to go see the worst movie and we're going to go to the worst restaurant. And this is all ironic. And my brother said to me, he's like, at what point is it no longer ironic and you're just a guy in his mid-30s who goes to Chili's? And it stopped me in my tracks, and I went, whoa. I went, whoa. And that whole day, I was thinking about it. I was like, I guess I do kind of like Chili's. Uh-huh. I was like, I like coming here. I like being here with my friends. It's the neighborhood bar and grill. Yeah. And I had to, like, step away from the irony, and I remember telling myself, I'm like, you're not better than Chili's. Right, and I think right. That's the feeling you're approaching this restaurant with. And a lot of these things that you've deemed as lesser than that you're going to dabble in.
Right.
It's you think you're better than them. And it's funny that you're lowering yourself to enjoy them. Right. And I had to check my ego. And I was like, you're not better than any of these things. In fact, these things are remarkable.
Right.
And so I always kind of that's internalized whenever I go like, I want some peeps. It's like, let's go enjoy a modern marvel.
Right. Well, the thing that – thank you for sharing that. The thing that makes me think about is one of my other favorite lines from when you did the story about this is you talked about how sometimes at those Christmases where your brother would give you peeps, there was a part of you that was like, can you just give me the money that you spent on this? And at one point you said there's like a cell phone bill's worth of peeps under this tree. Which is really funny. But the thing it made me think about when you said that is, yeah, there's a version of that Christmas where he says to you, hey, how about if instead of a Christmas gift this year, I'll help you out with your cell phone bill, which is also very loving. But that's not the same as touching this idea that you referenced at the beginning about, like, remember how when we were kids, Christmas wasn't always what we wanted it to be. This is a way of saying now it is.
Yeah. I think when we have those moments together, siblings, it is, there's that internal, I guess, emotional checkpoint for us to reflect on what this always looked like for us. And we've lost siblings and our mother has passed. And so it's actually gotten, like, really emotional in a very silly way. The last Christmas he gave me peeps, I, like, started crying. Oh, man. It became really deep, and I'm kind of getting emotional now because I think about how much I love him.
Yeah. Well, Anwar Newton is a comic and a storyteller here in Phoenix. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, whether it is candy or a tree in the yard, hope you've got something in your life that connects you to the people or maybe the bugs that you love. Leaving candy out, by the way, great way to attract bugs if that's what you want to do. Either way, I hope we've sweet-talked you into listening to the show again tomorrow morning at 9. We will be right back with you with another great episode. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.